Good morning, everybody, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, June 29th, 2014. My name is Leah, and I'm your moderator this morning. The share ID for Friday, June 27th, is 6566. That's 6566. This morning, A Vision for You presents, we had but two alternatives. Once you've accepted step one, admitting that you're powerless over food and that your life has become unmanageable, you've realized that to continue compulsive overeating means disaster. So does continuing to rely entirely on yourself to stop compulsive overeating. Now, if you already know that you can't rely on yourself, then your choices narrow down to either relying on some power greater than yourself or being doomed to a compulsive overeater's miserable existence or death. These aren't easy alternatives to face, but they're the only ones you've got. If you truly want to recover from the illness of compulsive overeating, you've got to have a spiritual experience. Here to speak further on this topic this morning is Mary F., a recovered compulsive overeater who resides in Sarasota, Florida, and is dedicated as a messenger of Overeaters Anonymous. And welcome to the line, Mary F.
Thank you very much, Leah. Can you hear me okay?
Indeed. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mary. I am a compulsive overeater and very, very grateful to be with you this morning on the line. Thank you, Leah, for inviting me to speak, and I consider it a great honor and a great opportunity to share the miracles that I have received and experienced in my years in Overeaters Anonymous. And I could not be more grateful to be with you today. I would just like to start with the Serenity Prayer. And so I'm just going to say that. You can say that along with me. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. I'm going to start my timer here for about 55 minutes, and then we'll do the questions and answers after that. I am a recovered food addict, or compulsive overeater. I have been coming to Overeaters Anonymous since 1985. I went to my first meeting back probably in 84 or 85. I am a survivor of relapse. I have spent some years in relapse between when I came and 1990. I have not found it necessary to pick up and eat compulsively since January 21st of 1990. That's a little over about 24 and a half years, and that is not due to me. That is due to this miraculous program of Overeaters Anonymous, the 12 steps that have led me to a relationship with a power greater than myself that has enabled me one meal at a time, one moment at a time, one day at a time, one year at a time to be abstinent and to abstain from compulsive overeating. And this is a miracle of this program, and I am immensely grateful. My top weight was 340 pounds. That's the weight that I know of when I went into treatment for the first time in 1986. I have been able to maintain about between 195 and 200 pound weight loss now for about 22 years. And that is a wonderful, 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 wonderful gift of this program, because I can do so many things today that I could not do when I weighed 340 pounds. But I will today, during this time that I am with you, show you, hopefully, and help you to see that that is just one benefit of what I have found through living these last 24 years in the steps, traditions, and concepts of the of Overeaters Anonymous. And today, my topic was we had but two alternatives. And I'm going to primarily share my story because I have not had that opportunity, or I've not taken that opportunity yet on the Vision for You. I spoke another time in December. I was on the abstinence panel, which was delightful. But today I'm going to share, focus more on my personal story. And on page, the two pieces of literature that I will be using today primarily are the AA Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the AA 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. Those are my two primary sources of literature and really the ones that I read most consistently on a weekly and if not daily basis. So on the bottom of page 25 in the chapter, there is a solution in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The bottom paragraph speaks to this. We had but two alternatives. And it says, if you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle of the road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other was to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. Well, in my story today, you are going to hear that I have spent time in both of those alternatives, a lot of time, wanting to blot out, to go on to the bitter end, the consciousness of my intolerable situation. And then what happened that I sought spiritual help and what has been the result? What I want to share with you is my story. I don't speak for OA as a whole. I owe my life to Overeaters Anonymous. I also want to share that I may kind of go in and out of my story and interject a lot from the literature because that is so much of my story. I believe that I was born with an abnormal relationship with food. I, from a very early age, I was overweight. I started probably being abnormally overweight by the time I was about 4 or 5 years old. By the time I was in third grade, I weighed almost 160 pounds. And that is less than I weigh today as a 61-year-old adult woman. I went on my first diet when I was in eighth grade. My mother took me to my doctor, and I was put on diet pills. And I was able to lose about 30 pounds, and I was able to participate in a class trip that I went on with some students and some classmates of mine. I think that was the reward that my father offered me at that time. If I were to lose weight, and I did. I lost about 30 pounds, and I got my little reward and came back, and I think I started eating again. I don't know how many times I have been taken to the doctor or given by a doctor a 1,000-calorie diet. Here's a 1,000-calorie diet, Mary, just go and do it. And I don't know once that I was ever able to do that after that first attempt when I was in eighth grade. And after that, I was given these diets. I was handed these sheets of paper and told to go and do what was impossible for me to do. I had, as the disease progressed, my periods of control got shorter and shorter. My second diet that I remember was when I was in high school, and I joined one of the major weight loss centers for the first time. as I was just going into my senior year of high school, and I weighed in at 290 pounds. And I don't mention specific weight loss programs by name. I think they are an outside interest, and I think that those programs work for normal people. But for people like me, if you were as seriously alcoholic as we were, as it says here on page 25, if you were as seriously compulsive overeater as I was, that those programs just didn't work for me for the long haul. I will tell you that I have gained and lost 100 pounds 5 different times in my life. So I have had success with those programs, but they didn't solve the real problem. Because the real problem is, as described in the literature, is that I have an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. And that I am different from a normal person. Normal people do not experience this twofold illness that's described so well in our literature. And so I joined that diet. I started that diet club when I was a senior in high school. By the time I graduated, I was down to about 170 pounds. However, nothing changed in me except my weight. Except my size. I still thought of myself as being 290 pounds. I still saw myself being really heavy. I still had cravings and obsessions and thoughts about food that were abnormal. And what happened was, after I had lost that weight, without cheating one time during that whole period, I bought into the delusion, the belief again, that I could control my food. And I decided that I would just go off of my diet for a period of time and then go back on it again when I wanted to. And so I did. And over that summer, I started to gain weight again, not knowing that even at that age, I believe that I was a progressed compulsive overeater, unable to control my food and stop when I wanted and start when I wanted. I believe that I am addicted to certain foods. Primarily, those foods for me are sugar, flour, and volume. I choose to weigh and measure all of my food today because I am addicted to volume. I can't eat certain foods in moderation at all, and all kinds of foods can create an obsession for me and a craving for me when I eat to excess volume. I tried many things. Like I said, I tried many weight loss programs. I tried fasting. I tried not eating at all. I tried giving myself permission to eat anything I wanted, thinking then that I wouldn't want to eat it. And I want to tell you, it never worked for me. I remember eating chocolate chip cookies, thinking that one day I'm going to get sick and tired of chocolate chip cookies. Well, it's never happened, and I don't think it will ever happen. I am not wired in that way. Maybe that works for some normal people, but it doesn't work for me. I have tried prayer. I have tried spiritual cleansing through a type of exorcisms. I have tried people praying over me, praying that the evil gluttony would be rid from me, because I always thought that I was just a glutton. I always thought that I was just a sinner, and that if I could just ask God to remove me from this sin, from sin, and if I could just restrain myself enough and not indulge in that, that I would be okay. I felt so badly about myself because I couldn't stop. I knew that I was eating in a way that wasn't right, and I felt like I was just I remember calling myself a fat blob of humanity. I was just a blob of humanity. Particularly, I felt that way when I was growing up so obese as a child and as an adult. It was very, 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 very painful. I have tried acupuncture. I have tried hypnosis. I have tried drinking lots of water before I ate my meal, and nothing would work for any long period of time. I would have periods of reprieve, periods of self-control, and then be completely out of control. What I didn't understand at the time was that I cannot eat certain foods in moderation, and that parallel with my sane thinking also always ran an insanely trivial excuse to pick up the food. And then I would be thinking I was okay, and then some insane thought would come across my mind, and I would be out again eating. This is described on page 37, where it's talking about insane thinking. And it said, you may think that this is an extreme case. We've been talking about a gentleman named Jim. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the circumstances. But there was always the curious phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. And for me, it was the first bite. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. The next day we would be asking ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity how it could have happened again. I had such an insane battle in my mind. Yes, I will. No, I won't. Yes, no, I can't. I'm trying to lose weight. I can't do this. I can't eat one. Oh, yes, you can, Mary. Just have one. You can have one. It's okay. I'll start tomorrow. And the insanely trivial excuse would always win out. And why is that? Because the insanely trivial excuse at that time was more powerful in my mind than my rational thinking. I did not believe that I had a disease that would cause me to eat more once I picked up. I did not believe the lies that my disease told me. I could not bring to my mind with sufficient force the memory of the previous binge. And this is talked about so clearly right on page 24, the page before we talked about the two alternatives. At the top of the page, it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We were unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first bite, or first drink. And this paragraph speaks so strongly about my experience. I had lost the power of choice. Now, does that mean that every single time I picked up, I ended up in a full-blown relapse and remorseful and hating myself? It doesn't, because it says here, we were unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force. There were times when I could stop. There were times when I did believe, no, I don't want to do this today. But at certain times, I couldn't. The suffering and the humiliation of a week ago or a month ago, or for me, it could have been hours ago, were insufficient to stop me every time. I would succumb once again, and I would be in the horrid, intolerable situation of being down in the food again. When I was, this progressed through my teens, through my 20s, Even in my very early 20s, I was diagnosed with stage 3B Hodgkin's disease, which is a cancer of the lymph nodes. And most people, when they're going through, I was given 3 years to live when I was 20 years old. And most people, when they go through cancer treatment, they lose weight. But I didn't. I turned to food. I turned to food, and I gained 40 pounds during my cancer treatment. And the doctors were amazed. They couldn't believe that I did not lose my appetite. But for me, food was my solution. Food was my solution. I didn't go to a higher power. I have heard it said that the person or the thing that we go to for comfort in our times of need, in our times of most pain, that or that person or that thing is our higher power. And for me, food had long ago become my higher power, particularly sugar, flour, fatty products. That was what I went to when I needed comfort. And excuse me, just one moment, please. I had to just quiet somebody here in my home. When I was in my early 30s, it got so intolerable. I could not stop binging. I was gaining weight so rapidly. I had gained, after my mother passed away, I gained 80 pounds in the first 6 months after she died. Again, it was turning to food to deal with life, my solution. In my mid-30s, I went to OA for my... In the early 30s, I went to OA for the first time. I thought it was kind of insane. I didn't really like it a whole lot. There was a lot of talk about God. I had tried God. I thought God had failed. I wasn't very interested in it. But I did go to the weight loss program that was across the hall, and at that one, over the weekend, I had gained, from 1 week to the next, I had gained 7 pounds one time, and a piggy sign was put around my neck that I was supposed to wear during the meeting, and then bring it back the next week. And you know, that seemed to fit for me. That seemed to be what I thought about myself, that I was just a pig, and it was, honest to God, that was reinforced by the people around me, people who said things like, "Mary, you're an adult. Just put the fork down. What's wrong with you? You know what to do. Just stop eating. Why are you doing this? And then at the same time, they'd be saying, "Have one. Just have one." And it just felt crazy and insane to me. But in 1986, I went back to an OA meeting, and at the time they were handing out food plans, and I picked up a food plan that that I tried for 1 day, and I couldn't stick to it for 1 day. I just couldn't do it. And on the back of it, there was a phone number at the time, and I called it, and it was a treatment center, and I didn't know that. This is the number that I called. I said, "You know, my name is Mary. I can't stop eating. I need to be locked up. Do you know where I could go?" And that's exactly what I felt. I needed to be locked up. And they said that I had, you know, called the right place. Anyway, I ended up going away to treatment for 7 weeks. And while I was there, I learned a lot about my disease. I learned a lot about the 12 steps. I learned a lot about weighing and measuring. And I got out of there after 7 weeks. I went in at 340 pounds. I got out. I had lost some weight. And I started working a very rigorous OA program. And I started working the steps. I got a sponsor. I was committing my food. I was weighing and measuring my food. I was doing all the things that I knew to do. I was making phone calls, going to meetings, being of service. Working with other people. Eventually I was sponsoring, and I was doing all the things that I thought would that other people were telling me to do. And I had great success. And I was losing weight, and I was beginning to feel more at home in my body and more better about myself, and I was being of service to other people, and I was working the steps, and I was starting to have this psychic transformation that is talked about in the big book, and I was doing really well. And thinking slowly, after a year or so, probably about a year and a half of clean abstinence and really rigorous working of the OA program, my thinking started to change again. And I believe the last thing we do in a relapse process is pick up the food. And so in probably about 1987, 1988, I started what I call chipping away at the program. And it wasn't with the food, it was chipping away with my disciplines. Oh, I wouldn't go to as many meetings. Oh, I wouldn't make as many phone calls. Oh, I let up a little bit on my step work. Oh, well, wasn't really honest with my sponsor about something. Another one was, a big one for me was, I'm such a volume addict, and I didn't have to weigh and measure my food in a restaurant. So I didn't weigh and measure. I don't believe everybody has to do that, but I do. So I started not weighing and measuring some of my meals in restaurants. But I wasn't eating sugar and flour, so there I'm still abstinent, I told myself. And this was long before, this was before I started, I really picked up the food. This was chipping away at the foundation of my recovery, of the recovery that I had been able to get here in Overeaters Anonymous. And I, chipping away, and finally the foundation collapsed. And then I ended up full blown face down in the food again. And it was like, what happened? What did I do? What went wrong? And it was only in hindsight, by really taking an inventory of what went wrong, that I was able to see what I had done. I had started thinking that I was a normal person again. I had started thinking that I could eat, and not eat at that point, because eating wasn't in my mind, that I could behave like a normal person, that I didn't have to do these disciplines, that I'm so recovered, I don't need to do this. And I was experiencing a level of recovery that was beautiful, but I started making it less of a priority in my life. I live my life today by saying that I need to build my life around my recovery rather than my recovery around my life. In the beginning, I did, but then life started becoming, well, I have to be able to do this, and I want to be able to do that, and I can lighten up on these disciplines that have literally saved my life, and I did. And I spent the next 4 years, 3 years, in full-blown relapse, miserable, defeated, depressed, suicidal, hopeless, despairing. The big book, or the AA 12 and 12, has some of the words in here. Literal hell, absolute humiliation, insane urge, fatal progression, the horrible nature of my disease was in my face, and I couldn't face it. I experienced just the humiliation and the destructiveness of this disease. And during that time, I tried many diets again. I went, tried many weight loss programs again. I tried OA again, in and out, back and forth, therapy. I was in therapy weekly, but not being honest with my therapist. I would binge on the way there, go in there, say I was doing okay, binge on the way home. I was desperate. I tried everything imaginable. And once again, I had lost about 60 pounds. I had joined a weight loss program. I lost about 60 pounds. I got to the magic 200 pounds again. And on December 7th of 1989, I decided that I could have one piece again, that that I had lost 60 pounds. I had gotten down to the 200-pound magic mark, and this insane thought came to my head again. Mary, you can have just one. Just one. Just one piece. So on December 7th of 1989, I remember the day, I picked up one piece of pie, fully convinced that I was going to be able to stop again. And I couldn't. I couldn't, not for one day. Not for one day. And I binged every day until January 20th of 1990. I binged for 42 days and gained 56 pounds, completely out of control, completely hopeless, completely despairing. And I could not stop. My periods of where I talked before about having times where I could bring it to my mind, at certain times I could bring my to my mind sufficient force, I couldn't. By now, the disease, the phenomenon of craving was so strong in me, the phenomenon of craving that's described in the doctor's opinion was so strong in me that I could not stop, not for one meal. Now, when I took that one bite, did I think that that was going to happen? Absolutely not. I believed the lie that I was going to be able to stop again. No one could have told me that I would spend 42 days, gain 56 pounds out of control. During that time, I knew that I couldn't stop, and I thought, life is not worth living. The alternatives that I were facing was facing either life without the food or life with the food was unbearable to me. And I decided that I would eat until I died. I had a very conscious choice that I would eat until I died. My husband at the time and I had my entire funeral planned, what I was going to wear, what songs that were going to be sung, who was going to do my funeral, who was going to be the minister. Every detail was planned, and I didn't care. I truly did not care. I welcomed death at this time. I was 37 years old, and I welcomed death. I was done. I had battled this disease long enough. I'm done. Life is not worth living. I cannot live in this battle. I was battle weary. And yet somehow there was this little tiny glimmer of hope in me. And it had to have been a power greater than myself, because there was nothing inside of me that I knew that had any willingness to keep on living, to any willingness to fight, any willingness to do this one more moment. But something inside of me said, Mary, call the treatment center that you were in. Call again. And I spent some time with another friend of mine in OA, and she had encouraged me to just try one more time. My husband at the time did not support it. You've already done that. You've already been there. You know what to do. Just do it. You're not a child. Just put the fork down. Just do it. And, I used to complain and holler at him, you don't understand. But the truth is, I didn't understand either. I kept saying to myself, Mary, just do it. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Why can't you just stop? And I didn't understand this disease any more than anyone around me did. And because I thought that I could just stop as well and that I should be able to. But on January 20th, 1990, I got on an airplane and I flew to a treatment center again where I had worked with this therapist before. And I went into treatment and I did everything that was told to me to do. And I got abstinent right away. I started weighing and measuring my food. It was a very 12-step model of treatment. I started committing my food. I started doing the assignments right away. The assignments in this place were on steps 1, 2, and 3, and the beginning was just really deep, deep, rigorous step one work, looking at my powerlessness over food. We admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives had become unmanageable. And I started listing all the ways in which my in which I was powerless, how I had tried to control, my periods of control, and then what happened, my consequences, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, social, financial. I listed all of these things. I did just incredible work, deep, rigorous first-step work on ways in life in which my life was unmanageable, ways that I had tried to control. I did this incredible first step. After you did all these assignments, you wrote this first step. It was like 45 minutes long to read it. I read it to the whole community. Everybody was like crying after I read it, and I said, I could have done more. If I just would have tried harder, if I just would have tried harder, I know I could have done more. I was still thinking that it was me, that it was my self-will, that if I just tried harder, I could do it. And the staff could see that I wasn't getting it. And in one of the staffing meetings, they said, you know, we think that Mary's going to die. She doesn't get it. She doesn't get that she's powerless over food. She thinks that she can control it, that there's more some self-will that she can exert, and then she can get control of this. And so what they did for me was they did a mock funeral for me. And I was to write my goodbye letters to family, friends, everyone. And they didn't talk to me for a couple of days while I was there. Everybody walked around talking about how this disease had killed me. And, you know, I didn't care. I welcomed it. I didn't care. I wrote my goodbyes letters very seriously because I was ready to go. I was done. And the day of my funeral, there was, you know, they came in with dark clothes on and quiet music in the room, and it was a funeral. And I said, I read my goodbye letters. I cried a little bit, and but I didn't care. And after I got done doing all of that, they laid me on the floor and covered me head to toe with a sheet, completely covered me, and I didn't care. I laid on the floor, and they said a little mock funeral thing for me, and people came up and said goodbye to me one at a time, and I had a few tears, but I truly didn't care. I was ready to go, and I was exhausted. And yet somebody came up to me and knelt down next to me and pretended to be my little sister, who is 20 years younger than me. I was 20 when she was born, and she was just like me. And she was a food addict herself. And somebody came up and pretended to be Jenny. And my parents had both died when she was really young. And then she said, this little young person that came up and knelt down pretending to be Jenny said, you know, Mommy and Daddy left me already. Now you've left me too. And I just started sobbing. And I got off of the floor. I threw the covers back and got off the floor and picked up this bat and was banging and banging and banging about at the disease and what it had robbed me of my whole life. My whole life had been imprisoned to this disease. And I did that, and that was incredibly, incredibly powerful. And then through the course of the next few weeks while I was there, they kept telling me this part that I read about, that being there is no return through human aid. And there's another part in the big book that says we were 100% hopeless apart from divine help, 100% hopeless apart from divine help, and not a little bit hopeless, 100% hopeless. And they were telling me that I needed to develop a relationship with a power greater than myself. And they were encouraging me to get on my knees and to pray. And I wasn't very interested in that. I was pretty angry at God. But they kept telling me to get on my knees and pray morning and night. And I don't think there's anything special about getting on my knees. But it was just a level of surrender and humility that I wasn't very interested in. On page 43 is where it says we are 100% hopeless apart from divine help. And but finally, I said, fine, I'll get on my knees and I'll pray. And I got on my knees that night, finally, after balking for quite a while. And I don't want to offend anyone, but I just said, F you, God, amen. And I stood up. And the next morning, my prayer again was, F you, God, amen. And I stood up. And for many mornings and nights in a row, that was my prayer. And because I was really angry at God. How could I bow down, humble myself before God, and think that this God is going to care for me, and even think of the concept of step three of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, of a higher power who had allowed so many painful things in my life. I was terrified of that. I mean, what loving God would allow a child to be raised or to grow up so morbidly obese? What loving child? These were my thoughts. What loving God would allow a 19-year-old woman to go through cancer treatment and become sterile? What loving God would allow me to be sexually abused by a minister? What loving God would allow that I could turn my life over, would allow the pain that I had had? How could I trust? I've cried out and yelled out and begged and pleaded for so many years for help from you, God, and now I'm being asked to pray. It just didn't make any sense to me, and everything in me revolted against it. But I was willing to follow the direction of getting on my knees and asking for help. And so that was my prayer for many days and many nights, many mornings and many nights. And one day, finally, I said my little intro prayer there, and then I just started crying. And I said, God, if there's any hope of recovering, I need to have a relationship with you. I need to find a relationship with you. And I think that first prayer that I said was the most honest prayer I had ever uttered in my life. And it was my truth. It was my truth. I couldn't come to a place of, you know, God, I love you, I need you, I want you in my life, when I had all of that terror, really. It was terror and anger at God. And today, you know, this 12-step program has just one day at a time brought me to a place where I do have a working, loving relationship with a power greater than myself that has restored me to sanity. Another thing that happened when I was in the treatment center was that they knew that I was in huge denial that I had a physical illness. And they could get it that I thought it was just a matter of willpower. I didn't get that, you know, my body was different, my mind was different. It's just my will, you know. And so they gave me the assignment to read the doctor's opinion in the big book three times a day, every day. Now, most of you, who, if you've spent any time on this Vision for You meeting, you are well aware and well familiar with the doctor's opinion. It's in the beginning of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was given the assignment to read this three times a day, every day. And I did that for about 9 months. And it eventually broke through my denial. I eventually got to see that I have an allergy to certain foods, that I have a phenomenon of craving that is limited to people like me. Okay, when we were on page 25, if you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, okay, back to the doctor's opinion. It says this phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So I am as seriously alcoholic. I am as seriously addicted. I do have this phenomenon of craving in my body that says that these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form or my addictive foods in any form at all. Because once the habit is, once I do it, my self-confidence, my reliance, my upon human things, everything is gone. I'm done. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by the alcohol. This sense of ease and comfort that can come at once by taking certain foods into my body. I was addicted to that. I was that's what happens in my body when I eat certain things. And the other aspect of that the doctor's opinion talks about, that's the physical aspect where I cannot eat certain foods, and that was so clear to me on when I had picked up on December 7th of 1989. That phenomenon of craving was so strong in me that I could not stop. So I am convinced today that my body is different. But it took me a lot of readings of this book, of this chapter, to get that into my mind. And then that would be fine if I didn't have the obsession of the mind. We hear that so much on the Vision for You meeting that, you know, it's fine if I have the allergy and then I'm aware of it. I'm allergic to penicillin, but I want you to know I don't test it. I don't go in and say, well, today give me a little penicillin. I think I'll be able to control it. I'll just call my sponsor. Give me a little penicillin. I'll just go to an extra meeting. Give me a little penicillin. I'll just confess it. Give me a little penicillin. I'll just use my mind to overcome it. Give me a little penicillin. I don't. I have sane thinking around my allergy to penicillin, but I don't have sane thinking around my allergies to certain foods, or at least I didn't. And so I would succumb again. I would give in. And then the vicious cycle would start again. The phenomenon that I would give in to the thinking, that I would eat, the phenomenon of craving would be in place. I would have a well-known spree, emerging remorseful, resoluting never to do it again. And then the whole thing would start over again. I'd be suicidal. I'd be desperate. And the whole phenomenon of craving, or the whole cycle, would go on and on again. But in the doctor's opinion, it says, what is the solution? At the very top of Roman numeral 31, it says, what is the solution? And then they talk about a gentleman who had come to Dr. William Silkworth, and he said the solution is that he accepted the plan outlined in this book. And he's talking about, of course, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And what is the plan that he's referring to? Well, it is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the plan that is outlined in this book so beautifully. And that is the other alternative. I think I've done pretty well describing what the one alternative was, going on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation as best I could, being willing to die for the food. And the other alternative was to accept spiritual help. Well, when this was first introduced to me, as I told you, I was very, very resistant. But eventually, I started to believe that the people that were telling me this had something that looked much better than what I had. Back on page 416 in the big book, it's a section of acceptance was the answer. It's a part in the big book, the chapter in the big book that we used to be called Dr. Alcoholic Addict, and it's a part on acceptance that we read so much. But right before the paragraph before that, on page 416, near the bottom of the page, it said, it helped me to become convinced that alcoholism was a disease and not a moral issue, that I had been drinking as a result of a compulsion, even though I had not been aware of the compulsion at the time, and that sobriety was not a matter of willpower. The people of AA had something that looked much better than what I had. And I will just stop there and say the people around me had something that looked much better than what I had. There were people who were abstinent, who were not suicidal, who were gaining some respect, who were able to not eat compulsively, who were losing weight, who were not in obsession, who were not hiding, lying, cheating, stealing about food. They were sane. They had some sane thinking about food. They were being of service to other people. They had something that looked much better than what I had, but I was afraid to let go of what I had in order to try something new. There was a certain sense of security in the familiar. I was really afraid to let go and to really try. I had felt like I had failed so many times. I felt like I was it couldn't possibly work for me. But somehow, I started to believe the people who were in these rooms, for whom it was working. And then I just clung to these people like my life depended it, because it does. You know, that what started out as a flimsy reed, I don't know where that is right at this moment, but what started out as a flimsy reed became my absolute anchor. I think that's in We Agnostics someplace. It absolutely became exactly what I needed, and I clung to it like my life depended upon it, because it does, and it still does. And I want to tell you, that was 24 years ago, and I still do the same things almost exclusively. I have a sponsor. I don't think in the last 24 years there's been a day that I have not had a sponsor. I do commit my food every day very specifically. I commit anything I eat before I eat it. I check in with my sponsor the next day as to whether or not I did that. I am addicted to certain foods. I weigh and measure all of my food without exception, and that means anywhere, anytime, any place. Why? Because I am addicted to volume. I do step work every single day of my life because it's the steps that have restored me to sanity. It's the steps that have taken, that have removed the, and continue to remove, because I'm not perfect, that I continue to work on every day, the blocks that separate me from God, myself, and others. I have, by the grace of God and the incredible sponsorship and fellows in this program, been able to make amends and restore my relationships with other people. I have developed a trust and reliance upon my higher power that, believe me, is still imperfect. I mean, I frequently forget to turn things over to God. My sponsor will say to me, "Oh, are you praying about that?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I completely forgot about that." You know, thank you for reminding me. I completely forgot about God. You know, I am like. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, and I still consider myself such a student of this spiritual life. And I've had my weight off for a long time. It's so not about that today. But I am not so recovered that I do not need to continue to do these disciplines every day. I am restored. I am recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I am recovered from that today. And I have to work on recovery every single day and not letting up on these spiritual disciplines. I go to a lot of meetings. I am of service. I sponsor people. One day at a time. And I will tell you, about 10 years ago, even though I was rigorously abstinent, I was pretty miserable in my life. I had a lot of things that were, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I had a sponsor. I was cleanly abstinent, but I was slipping away, chipping away, like I talked at the beginning, with my spiritual program of action in regard to step work. I was talking to my sponsor, but we were not in a process of daily step work. And I had joined a step writing group, and I think we met every other Sunday night. And I had great intentions to do, to spend time working on my step, whatever I was on at the time, every day. I had great intentions of writing on it, reading and writing on it every day, and then coming into my step group and sharing about what had happened. But, you know, my great intentions, until I had the accountability of going to that step group either every Sunday night or every other Sunday night, I would usually be cramming and reading and writing right before I went to my step group. and I was becoming more and more miserable. And I knew that I was restless, irritable, and discontent a lot of the time. And somebody that I knew that was really involved in a rigorous step process kept telling me, you know, I would call and I would complain to her about somebody that was in my life, and I was miserable, and I would just complain about this person, and this person who was just really working the steps, she would say to me, Mary, you know what it says in step 10 of the AA 12 and 12? It is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the problem, there's something wrong with us. And she would say that to me, and I would think, oh, yeah, there's nothing wrong with me. If you lived with this person, you'd be upset too. You'd be pissed all the time. You'd be angry. You'd be upset too. Don't tell me that something's wrong with me. But then I'd call her a day or two later, and I'd be complaining and bitching again about this person, what he's doing. And she would say, Mary, it is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. And eventually she told me that enough times, and I was in so much pain that I decided I needed to make a change and that I needed to get involved in something that was more disciplined around the step work. On page 52, it described me coming into this process of working more diligently around my step work. And again, I was cleanly abstinent. I was cleanly abstinent with the food, believe me. And it was just a matter of time before I ended up in the food because I was restless, irritable, and discontent and pissy all the time. Page 52, this was me about 10 years ago. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. That was me about 10 years ago, completely abstinent, completely thinking that I was just fine, but knowing that if I didn't get help, if I didn't surrender to something that I really didn't want to do, I was going to end up in the food again. So 10 years ago, I surrendered to a deeper step process for me that's been miraculous. It was one of those things, accepting spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. And I want to tell you that part of the reason I resisted was because I didn't want to do that much work. You know, the things that I have to do for my recovery today take a lot of time. I do a reading and writing assignment every day. I'm in these steps every single day. Do I think everybody needs to do that? No. But my level of disease around my thinking, around my spiritual life, that is what I require. Do I think everybody has to weigh and measure their food? No, but I do. That's the level of the disease that I have. I have to be very rigorous about these things in my disease, in my recovery. And so I have to do that. And I just, you know, do a lot with the tools every day because they show me a way to work the steps. I use the tools as a way to get support to work and live the steps, to call upon people. How do you do this? How do you apply the steps in this situation? One of the greatest things that my sponsor has given to me is the third step prayer around every issue of my life. Like today, when I was leading up to when I was going to be speaking today, I said the third step prayer around this. I said, God, I offer the vision for you meeting on Sunday to you to build with this meeting and to do with this meeting as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will with this meeting. Take away my difficulties. that victory over them may bear witness to those on this meeting that I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do your will always. My sponsor has showed me a way, and my fellows have showed me a way to apply the steps in this program to every aspect, and the traditions to every aspect of my life. And my life is not perfect. But the things that I do, I don't always want to do, but the benefits are so beautiful. And today, I need a level of discipline and accountability. Back when I had great intentions to do step work every day, when I didn't have that accountability that I had to read that to my sponsor every day, I didn't do it. I had great intentions. There are a lot of people who are more self-disciplined than I am. But I'm just one of those people that just needs a lot of accountability, and I'm grateful for it today. And, you know, I am free. I am free in my body. I am free. I don't have obsessions. I don't have cravings. I don't have the food is in its place. The food is in its place. And now, as long as I do that every day, my life, I have an opportunity to walk in service and walk in an opportunity to show and to help other people along this path. And it's saved my life. There's nothing more that I desire in my life than to be able to grab hold of another compulsive overeater and say, there is a way out. There is hope. There is hope. There is hope. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share. And I think I'll pass with that. Thank you.
Mary, thank you so much for your service this morning. Thank you for sharing your miraculous transformation with all of us. Much appreciated. And we're going to share Mary's contact information at the conclusion of this recording. Now let's open the floor for any questions you might have for Mary, and you can direct your questions to her by pressing star 1 to unmute.
Hi, my name's Rasha, and I'm a compulsive overeater, and I have a question for Mary.
Please go ahead.
Hi, Mary. Wow. Wow, what a wonderful, wonderful share. You talked about how you do the program and you do it to a very strenuous level. I was wondering whether how you sponsor people who perhaps don't need as strenuous a level as you do, or do you ask them to seek someone else who has a different program than you? Thanks again.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you, Rosin, for the question.
Rasha,
thank you. I generally sponsor people who are willing to do what I do, or who need to do what I do, or willing to do what I do, because I have found that it has worked so well for me, and that's really all that I know to pass on. I've done a lot of different ways of working the steps, and I find that this works so well for me that that's the same way I sponsor.
Thank you, Rasha, for that question. Who's next?
This is Barbara S. I have a question.
Yes, good morning. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay. Mary, thank you very much for your story. It really speaks to me. You speak about doing reading and writing every day, and I was wondering if there is a program or a list of questions or how you determine that daily step work.
Well, thank you, Barbara, for the question. There are a lot of options around that. There are so many things that one can do. There are different questions that are available on different websites for people. There are, I mean, literally, you can pick up the big book and just start reading with someone else. Start reading and writing, taking a sentence or a paragraph at a time. It's always helpful for me to work with someone else with that, and to share my writing with other people and get feedback. So there are a lot of other of ways to do that. I am going through step four. There are a lot of formats that are available. Of course, I use the format from the big book, directly out of the big book, to work step four. But there are a lot of questions and things that you can get. If you'd like to talk to me about that privately, I'd be happy to do that.
That would be great. Thank
you. On the websites, there are lots of materials available.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Chaya.
Thank you, Barbara. Chaya, your turn.
Thanks, Leah. Hi, this is Chaya, grateful recover, compulsive eater and bulimic in Denver, Colorado. Thank you so much, Mary, and I can tell you I relate. My question is, could you describe, go into a little bit more depth of how you go through the process that's laid out in the big book that you so beautifully spoke about?
Well, thank you, Chaya. Are you speaking regarding the fourth step or what in particular?
Not specific. You said you go through the steps in a way, and I was wondering if you could perhaps, I mean, the fourth step is just one step, but if perhaps you can go through in a general way how you go through the steps.
Sure. Let me try and answer that for you. Regarding the, well, let me say let me give you an example of what I've done recently. I was working on judgment and control. I had a tremendous amount of judgment and control, and still do. My sponsor at the time had me go through the AA 12 and 12 and work and read the steps very specifically on my character defects of judgment and control. And I spent about a year doing this, going through the AA 12 and 12 on judgment and control. And I discovered a lot about myself, that underneath my judgment and control was really a tremendous amount of terror. And I, so that's one way in which I do work the steps around a particular issue. Regarding going through the big book, I think that by reading it, when I did my step work initially going through this, I did a particular set of questions that took me through steps 1, 2, and 3, and then when I got to step 4, I went to the big book and did it according to the way it's laid out in the big book, and then just went through what to do into action into step 5 and just went through it exactly that way, as it's laid out in the big book. I don't know if that answers your question enough sufficiently, Chaya.
Well, thank
Liz
you.
Liz L. from California.
Yes, go ahead, please. Chaya, thank you for the question. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, good morning, and thank you so much. And I have a question you talked about when you were so angry with God. And I was sexually abused by my father, and how to, well, I don't know if you can answer how to accept that, but also how do you stop that anger of God and really learn to trust? I know you said you were asked God to help you. How did you get through that and accept and feel the trust of God, even though about your experience?
What was your name again?
Liz from California.
Liz. How did I get through the anger and come to a point of trust in God? And I heard, Liz, that you had been sexually abused. I'm really sorry that was your experience. Well, it was being honest, first of all, I think. It was being honest, recognizing that I had anger. I still occasionally have anger at God, and I find that using the big book way of going through any resentment, whether it be at God, whether it be at myself, whether it be at someone else, is a good way of doing it and looking at where am I angry? You know, who am I angry at? Why am I angry? What is it that they have done that's caused me to be upset? And then looking at what it affects, what are my basic instincts that it affects, and then praying the prayer in there, you know, that I am spiritual. They are spiritually sick, just the way I am spiritually sick. That I don't like what they've done, but that I am sick too. And I sometimes think that in a situation where, like, I was sexually abused by my pastor, somebody that I went to for help. And it was very important for me to differentiate, to separate my pastor from God, and the person that had sexually abused me from God, because they are not the same. And I was very angry at God for allowing some things that happened to me that were very, 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 very painful, and certainly, you know, caused me a lot of harm. And the person that perpetrated the abuse on me, I was angry at them as well. And when I was able to separate the two, and then I could see that the symptoms were some, you know, I had some of the same symptoms of hurting other people, of causing harm to other people. But where I talked about in the AA 12 and 12, when I was talking about it is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. What I got when I was reading that, so when I was really studying that, well, what could be wrong with me in a situation like this? What could be wrong with you, Liz, in a situation where, you know, you have upset, you are disturbed because of abuse situation that happened to you in your past? That was, I would say, how could I be... Yes, I am disturbed by what happened to me, but how is that? How am I? What is wrong with me about that? It's them. But what I got was, what was wrong with me was if I didn't do the spiritual work to forgive and to accept that this is the way it was, what was wrong with me was I could end up using again. I could end up going back into the food. So I had to deal with my resentments. I had to. I don't have a choice, because resentment, the big book tells us that resentments are fatal and that they separate us from God. They cut us off from the sunlight of the spirit. So I have to find a way, and the big book outlines, and the AA 12 and 12 show us how to deal with our resentments. Because for me, there is something wrong with me if I am harboring a resentment. If I'm disturbed about something, there is something wrong with me. Not only am I spiritually sick, I believe that I have, you know, the first thing that I was able to become aware of was that what was wrong with me was, if I don't deal with this, I'm going to eat, okay? So that was what was the gateway, that was the doorway to get me into looking at, where am I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened? The doorway was, Mary, you've got to deal with this, otherwise you're going to end up eating. It's the number one offender. You know, more people end up drinking over resentment than anything else. For us, it is fatal. So that I got first. Then, with the help of a good sponsor, was able to look at, where am I selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened? and my part in harboring the anger and resentment that I had toward this other person was that I wasn't accepting that this is the way it is. That this is, you know, for whatever reason, this is what happened, and I'm wanting things different. I'm being selfish when I'm wanting things other than they are. I'm playing God. I hope that was helpful, Liz.
Thank you, Liz, for the question. Anyone else?
Hi, this is Kathy in Illinois. I have a question.
Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you, Mary, so much for... I so relate to your story. You mentioned that we are left with two choices, going on to blotting out to the bitter end. I can't remember the words you used, or accepting spiritual help. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how you get from, as you put it, being willing to die to being willing to accept spiritual help. Does that make sense?
Yes, it certainly does. Thank you, Kathy, for the question. How did I get from being willing to die to being willing to accept spiritual help? I think it was really hitting bottom. Seeing that I was absolutely hopeless, left to my own devices, and that the only thing that was going to help me was spiritual. That I really got this. It was told to me so many times over and over again, Mary, you are 100% hopeless apart from divine help. And the divine help came to me in a form of human beings, really. I can't say that it was any one human being. It was a combination of the power of a power greater than myself. And it was for me, this is one of the things I didn't share when I was sharing my story. It was for me being in a very safe place for an extended period of time and being around people who could support me and love me and guide me. I was in treatment for that second time when I finally surrendered. I was in treatment for 5 weeks.
Mary, we lost you. Star one to unmute.
Oh, I don't know how that happened, but I'm back. Thank you very much. Thank you. I don't know if you heard that when I was in I was in treatment for 5 weeks, and then I was in a halfway house for 3 months. So I was basically in a very supportive, loving environment for 4.5 months. And I believe that the people, I left my job, I left my home, I had no idea whether I was going to get my job back when I got back from treatment. It didn't matter if I wasn't abstinent and if I wasn't in recovery. It didn't matter if I had a job. And I went away for 4.5 months, and I spent that time in treatment. And I believe that those people lovingly carried me until I could get stable. Now, I think that I was accepting spiritual help when I surrendered to the level of support that I needed. I think that's different for different people. I needed to be in an environment where I was completely engulfed in abstinence, food abstinence, and in spiritual recovery in the steps, to be with people who were doing what I had to do, what worked for me, to be with people. Now, back in the days of AA, how they would do that is they went and they lived with one another. You know, the guys in New York, they went out to Akron, and they lived with people for months. I mean, I think when Bill first went out to Dr. Bob, he went out there on a business trip, and he ended up staying for a few months, if my memory serves me correctly. And that happened all the time. We don't hear about that as much in OA today, that people need to be with people if their disease has progressed such that they are really struggling. And so for me, now this may sound a little different than what you're asking, but I think that this is the essence of it. I needed to be loved and nurtured in an abstinent environment and shown the way of working the 12 steps with people. I was too vulnerable. And so to get to that, you know, place of being willing to die and to accepting spiritual help, to me, it's a surrender issue. You know, it's like, am I willing to surrender to the level of support that I need? And I think that, you know, when I'm in the food, my mind, my thinking is so skewed that suicide looks like a great option. Being willing to die looks like a great option. Being willing to die for sugar, to me, looked like a great option. And I want to tell you, today I think, really? I really thought that? I was convinced of that, Kathy. Convinced that I was willing, that life would not be worth living without sugar, that life would not be worth living without the food. And so to me, I think the period that came from being willing to die to being willing to accept spiritual help was, first of all, surrender. I am beat. I cannot do this alone. I have to find a way of living and applying these 12 steps to my life if I hope to have any sort of a spiritual awakening that will solve my problem. And I cannot do that and keep doing the things I'm doing right now. I have to make a major transition in my life. I have to really be with people and surrender to the level of support that I need in order to begin this process.
Thank you, Kathy, for the question. Who's next?
This is Susan. May I ask a question?
Yes, Susan, go ahead.
Thank you both so much for your service and the really powerful message, Mary. You spoke about the abuse and your anger at God and needing to distinguish God from that individual. And you may feel like you've already answered this question. I did hear the entire discussion, but I'm not sure if you answered this. How do you feel you've been able to do work on or reconciling trusting God, and perhaps it's simply by making that distinction between that individual and God, but how have you worked on trusting God, and perhaps that comes up as you continue to work on judgment and control issues that I continue to work on? Thanks so much. I hope the question is clear.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Susan. So, regarding the abuse and anger at God, how have I reconciled or worked on trusting God? Well, I think this is an ongoing process. It came with time. It came with, I don't think I have complete and utter reliance on God, but I do know that what I do think I am aware of today is that there is that deep sense of knowing deep within me. And, you know, where it talks in We Agnostics about the great reality deep within, deep inside, I don't know if I can find that right now, but it's in We Agnostics. Reading through We Agnostics was very helpful to me. And I know it says it's the great reality deep within. I spend time trying to connect with that great reality deep inside of me. I don't understand it. I don't think that I have any understanding or concept of what or who God really is. All I can do, what I gather is when, by reading the big book and the 12 and 12, I gather a lot of spiritual descriptions of a loving God, direction. God is called all manners of things, sense of direction, power, peace, great reality. Here it is on page 55. It says, we saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the final analysis, it is only there that he may be found. And I tend to, I can feel that part in my gut. This is just for me. I can feel that part in my gut that I relate with as being my higher power. That sense of knowing, that sense of peace, that when I focus on that, I do have a sense of peace. And honestly, Susan, I think a lot of it is reading the literature, really taking it in, really studying the literature. With an awareness of that part in my body where I connect with the great reality deep within, I don't by any means have a perfect trust and reliance upon God, but I do know that when I, in the big book where it says, you know, we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves, I do have a sense of an awareness of that my finite self is insufficient. I can't, one of the things I do when I'm going through the fear prayer is, you know, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to all he would have me be. Before I say that fear prayer when I'm doing a fear inventory, I ask myself, you know, how have you tried to control this fear, Mary? What are the ways that you've tried to control it? Has it worked? No. Am I willing to trust infinite God rather than my finite self? And then I say the fear prayer. And I think, you know, that I have an imperfect relationship. I have an imperfect trust in a power greater than myself, but I have a growing trust in a power greater than myself. And another thing that I do is, again, this is all, it's to me, this whole process that I'm talking about right now is not a thinking process. It's a spiritual doing process on some levels. And so one of the other things that connects me with a power greater than myself is when I say the part in step 11 in the big book where it says, it's in the around page 80-something here, 86. The part in page, the middle of 86 where it says, on awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead, and that whole section from there until the end of the chapter, that is one of my prayers in the morning, that whole section. And I have said that the whole thing for so many times over the years that I have it memorized. And so I say it very prayerfully to myself on awakening. Let me think about the 24 hours ahead. I consider my plans for the day. And I do. I pause. I do that. Then before we begin, we ask God to direct my thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. And I say this very prayerfully. And there's something about doing this, this form of what the big book calls, this is in step 11 section, so this is considered prayer and meditation. This helps me to connect and to trust my higher power. I believe some of the things in here. I will intuitively know how to help, how to handle situations that used to baffle me. That's in the promises, but that we will we constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show. That the hunch or the occasional inspiration will gradually become a working part of the mind. That my thinking will change. I ask for freedom from self-will. I think that the trusting, growing in trust in God has been by doing what it says in this book. Every time that there is a prayer in the AA 12 and 12 or the big book, I put a little P in the margin with a little box around it for P for prayer. And I am somebody that really prays these prayers. And so this is how I am growing in my trust with God. I am growing in my trust with God. And of course, doing the resentments, just following the instructions. I think these principles work. That's all.
Thank you, Susan, for the question. And we'll take one final question this morning. Anyone else?
Suji.
Go ahead, Sue.
Hi, it's Suji from Southeastern Pennsylvania, a recovered member of the fellowship. I want to thank you for your service. Thank you so much, Mary. I mean, the honesty, openness, and willingness of your share blows me away. And if you think you're not self-disciplined, well, I sure think you're self-disciplined. I have a question, and I have no expectation about your even answering this question, because it's nosy of me at a certain level, but I'm also really asking for your experience, strength, and hope. I heard you about that psychodrama of your funeral, and I heard you say that there was a little sister 20 years younger, and that made you cry. Now, I have no idea if there really was a little sister or not, but if there is, and please feel free to not answer the question at all, but if there is, how has your relationship with that person changed in your recovery? Thanks. I pass.
Thank you, Susie. Well, one thing that you said at the beginning of what you shared, Susie, is I don't think that I'm self-disciplined. What I have done is I have let God discipline me, the way it says in the big book. You know, we let God discipline us, and I am not self-disciplined. I am disciplined because of accountability to other people and God. And that doesn't mean that I don't want to do these things. Where I started out today, I'm going to address this first. You know, I have two choices to make. You know, do I want to live in the pain of disease, whether it be in the food or even, you know, just craziness, or do I want to live, you know, in recovery? And it says, you know, this we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. I honestly want to do the disciplined things that I do today, but not every day. You know, some days I don't want to. I don't want to. Some days I'm like, oh, my God, I have to do this again? Even like, I'm tired. I have a whole, full life. I don't want to do this. But I have an accountability, and I get the results because of the accountability that I have and because I'm willing to do it. I am willing to make the effort today. But self-discipline, I don't have a lot. I need other people. I need other people. I cannot do this alone. So I just wanted to say that. And I want to today, and I'm willing to make the effort because of the results I get. Now, regarding my little sister, my little sister is, yes, I have a little sister. Her name is Jenny, and I was 20 when she was born, and we are the only two in my family who have, like, blonde hair, blue eyes, and this tiny, tiny little deformity of our left ear. We are the only two people in my family that have the identical thing. We are like twins 20 years apart. We were both, all of my siblings are food addicts, but both Jenny and I are and were. We were both very obese as children. Jenny, when she was 13 years old, she weighed 326 pounds. She was heavier than I was at the time. And I am connected to her. It was like she's my daughter. I mean, I did pretty much raise her from my mom died when she was 5. My dad died when she was 12. And we are very, very, very connected. She she has sought recovery in OA some. She is pretty stable today. She doesn't work a 12-step program, but she's pretty stable. She is a delight in my life. We have a very close relationship. She lives in Seattle, and I'm in Florida. But we have a close relationship, and she is a dear to me. So I don't think that's I'll answer just about anything. So thanks.
Thank you, Suji, for the question, and of course, Mary. Thank you so much for your time and your service to all of us on the line this morning. Thanks again to Rasha, Barbara, Haya, Liz, Kathy, and Susan and Suji for all the questions this morning. And I'm going to close the meeting in the way that A Vision for You always closes its meetings, and that's from page 164 in our big book. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.